Welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv. Great to have you guys on board again. And today what I thought I'd talk about is renovation, relocation, or detonation. Now this is one of the topics that has come up as a result of talking to a few students. And they've been looking at their portfolios and not really knowing what to do. You know, should we sell this property? Should we keep that property? Should we be renovating or, you know, move to another one where we can do more? Or should we be actually knocking it down and then building something new? So renovate, relocate, or detonate is the topic of today. Now, in order to really understand where you should go and what your next move needs to be, the first thing we need to do is to step back one step and really look at where you're at right now, obviously, and what you want to achieve. Because when you have a clearly defined, what I call peg in the sand, what that means is that you've got a direction and you've got a focal point on which to make decisions about whether, you know, you should do this or should do that. Does it take me closer to that peg in the sand, whatever that peg in the sand happens to be? So that's the first thing that we really need to do, is to work out what we're actually shooting for. Now, realistically, I mean, you can add a lot of fluff around the edges, but the reality is that when you start talking about a peg in the sand, it's probably going to fall into one of two categories, or predominantly one of two categories. Now, of course, I'm talking about financial peg in the sands here, not the ones like, you know, I want to go and do a cruise in Alaska, or I want to climb some mountain somewhere, or any of that sort of thing. No, what I'm talking about here is financial pegs in the sand. And as I said, they're probably going to be predominantly one or the other. So what are these two things? All right, first of all, you're either predominantly going to be income focused, which means that income replacement and having passive income is going to be your primary driving force. Or on the other side, it's going to be getting out there and gaining growth in your properties, or to gain equity, which is growth oriented. Now, of course, you're all going to have the fence sitters and say, oh, I want both. But really, when you cut to the chase, nobody ever really is going to be equal one way or another. They're going to be more predominantly cash flow, or they're going to be predominantly more growth oriented. And for the most part, I believe most people are going to be income oriented until such time as they've replaced their income. Having said that, some people, depending on where they're starting from, are going to have to start with an equity deal first, because their income is whatever it is. You know, they might be earned income, it might be from a job or a business or something like that. But because their equity pie is so low, they actually have to do an equity deal first. So the first thing we need to do is analyze your current situation. What is it that you want, as in what's your peg in the sand, and where are we starting from? So the first thing you should be doing is writing out your current financial position. Now, this is actually quite easy. All you need to do is to write out all of the assets that you have. Now, when we're deciding what an asset actually is, it's interesting to see what some people call an asset. For instance, for me, an asset is something that the bank will lend me money against and that produces me income. Now, obviously, you can have assets that the bank will lend you money against but don't actually produce your income. Now, they're the ones that, oh, yes, they're an asset and that they have a value, but they're not the preferred ones, let's say. So anyway, what are your assets when it comes to accounting terms? All right, they're going to be things like property. They're going to be anything that the bank will lend you money against. Now, in some instances, banks will lend you money against equipment and things like that. But for the most part, that's not normally the case. We're talking real estate for the most part. Some of you will have assets that you can sell. Now, if you're prepared to sell an asset in order to liquidate it and put that money into real estate, then let's count that as well. That might be shares as an example. It might be a collectible like a vintage car or something like that. And then other people will count things like a jet ski or a caravan. Well, I don't particularly want you counting any of those type of assets unless you're prepared to sell it, liquidate it, and put that money in as an asset. So that's the first thing. Work out what all your assets are. Now, put them down in a big list underneath each other. Then write the values beside them so we know exactly what that figure actually is. Now, this is the realizable value of those assets. Then the next thing I want you to do is to write down beside it what you owe against those assets. So any loans that you've got against the real estate or shares or anything else that you might have, write a figure down there. Now, at this point in time, what I'd like you to do is keep superannuation separate, because one day we'll talk about superannuation and I can show you what you can do over there as well. But for now, let's not do super. Let's just put it to the side and we'll start to talk about the non-super assets for now. So when we list out all of the loans that are against those assets, take one from the other, and that actually gives you your net asset value. So whatever your assets are, less all of your loans, what is it actually worth after that? So this is your net equity position. Now from there, what we need to do is to work out what of that is actually usable. Because for some of you, you aren't able to borrow as highly as other people are. Let me talk about that a little bit more. First of all, if you've got a high income, it may be worthwhile you borrowing at, say, 90 cents in the dollar, which are 90% what we call LVR or loan to valuation ratio. And the reason for that is because you get more available to go off and do things with. And if you're short on equity and high in income, that's exactly what you probably should be doing. So obviously you've got to be speaking to one of the Investor Loans Network guys to really understand that, you know, a strategist, a mortgage strategist around that. But probably that's going to be the case. And then if your income is, it's not quite so high, but you've got plenty of equity as well, well, probably it's going to be at 80 cents in the dollar. Now, if you're a low documentation applicant, which means that you might run a business or your taxable income's a little bit lower, things like that, then your LVR is going to be somewhere between 60% and 80%. It kind of depends on your situation. And again, you need to be checking these figures with your mortgage strategist to make sure that you know exactly what your loan to valuation ratio is going to be. And if you've got no income at all, then it's just going to be an asset lend, then your LVR is probably going to be around about the 60%. So that gives you some kind of idea as to how much of your net worth you're actually going to be able to use, because you won't be able to use every bit of it. You can only use up to your borrowing capacity, like an 80% or a 90% or a 60% perhaps, depending on where you're at. So work those figures out and then come up with what your available working equity is. So this is what you can actually take and go and do something with. Now, remember that, say that works out to, say, $200,000, just to give us a rough figure. That doesn't mean you can only go and buy a $200,000 property. That's not the case at all. What that means is that amount becomes your deposit plus your cost on your next property. So that's your 20% or 10% or 40% or whatever your LVR is, your opposite LVR. That's what that is. That's what that amount is. So if it was $200,000 and your LVR or your loan to valuation ratio is, say, 80%, well, that means that you could go and buy $1 million worth of property or thereabouts. So that gives you some kind of idea. So now we've worked out our parameters around how much equity we've actually got available to us to go and do the next deal. Now we can start to think about, okay, what does my next deal actually need to do for me? Now, in analysing that question, this again comes back to, okay, do I want to replace income first? Do I want to grow wealth predominantly? Which one am I more heavily weighted towards? And once you've worked that out, then it's a matter of deciding on What your available equity is and what your next move needs to be after that. So if your equity position is quite low, then you're going to have to go and do a manufactured growth deal to kind of build that up a bit, even if your overall goal is to replace income. So it's going to be a balancing act, but let me give you the drum. It's always going to be a balancing act. It's never going to be a situation where, you could just go off and do one strategy for the rest of your life. You're always going to be juggling this cash flow and equity position. So, next thing we need to do is to look at our existing portfolio. What can we do with that? And what I recommend you do here is if you've got existing properties, list them all out and go think about one individually and go, all right, what can I do with this property? Can I do anything to this property to make it worth more? For instance, could I renovate it? Could I subdivide it? Could I develop it? You know, what can I do to this property? And the other question you ask yourself is, how can I increase the income on this property to give me a higher yield? So this is where we start to do an analysis of our existing portfolio. And you need to be plugging in some figures like potential growth on the property in the future and its current income, whether it be positive or it be negative. And it gives you some kind of idea as to what your capacity is with your existing portfolio. Now, this is where we come to where I started. Do I renovate? Do I relocate to another property? Or do I detonate it and actually get in there and replace it with something else? Now, in analysing existing portfolios, what we need to look at is we basically need to work through a feasibility study on every single option. So rather than get caught up in the big picture of the enormity, oh, I don't know what to do, you know, if this is going to cost so much, but then if I did that, I could do this and I could do something like this. Stop all of that mind chatter. What you need to do is get your piece of paper out, your calculator, and go, all right, here are my options. Renovate, relocate to another property and do something somewhere else, or detonate it and do a development on the existing property. First of all, first option, renovate. Okay, now what we need to do when we determine whether we renovate is we start to go through and say, okay, I'm going to renovate. What does the feasibility actually look like? So this is where you go through room by room in your house or your property and go, all right, in this room, what needs doing? And you physically walk into that property, into that room, and you go, all right, let's look at it. Is the light fitting okay? Are the power switches need replacing? What about the flooring? What about the paint? What about the windows? What about the dressing on the windows? And you go through every single item in that room and work out whether it's, what needs to be done with that particular room. When you finish that, you move on and you go to the next room and you do exactly the same thing. Now, I call this doing a guesstimation. And, you know, on my website, there's plenty of stuff you can download about, guesstimation sheets and things like that. But you go through and you estimate out, okay, write down all the tasks that need to be done. And then you go through and say, okay, well, roughly what's that going to cost me? What's this going to cost me? All the rest of it. And you go through and you get an estimate of cost. Now, if you've never done this before, it'll probably take you a bit of time. But it's a jolly good thing for you to learn how to do, because by the time you've done three or four of them, I tell you what, you know your costings, you know roughly what it's going to be, and you'll very quickly come up with a roughy feezo as to what something like a renovation is actually going to cost you. Now, the first time, you might have to go onto, a few websites like Bunnings websites or, onto eBay and things like that and get an idea of what things actually cost, whether it be tiles or carpets or, curtains versus blinds and those sort of things, and start to list those out. So by the time you've gone through every single room and worked all that stuff out, you should have a relatively close idea as to what the renovation on the property is going to be. You do the same thing, obviously, with the outside. The outside's just like another room, you know, and you walk around the front of the house. Okay, this is the front of the house room. What do we do here? What's the fence look like? You know, what's the garden? Does it need a clean up? Do we need new lawn? Does the entrance of the house need a little bit of a makeover? What's the external of the house going to be? Do I have to do something at the front? Do I have to do it all the way around? Or will I just do something at the front and that'll be fine? You know, what's the fencing like? And you go on and you go through all the little bits all the way around, get a complete renovation costing list there, and then give it a rough figure as to what you reckon it's going to be. Add 10% just for good measure, and we've got a renovation costing there, ballpark. All right. Now, to finish off on the renovation, what we now need to do is to go out and start to have a look around at other properties in the area where your property is, that to get an idea of value after renovation. So after you've done all this stuff, what's it actually going to be valued at? And not just list price, but what they're actually selling at. So this is where you do your comparable sales analysis. And you get an idea as to what everything else is selling for. And so you know that you're not just wasting your time, that you're actually going to get good value for whatever it is that you're out there doing. So now we look at the value of your property now, the value of the renovation that's going to be put in onto the property. And obviously you've got to add in, you know, the tradesman for the things that you can't do, and or, you know, tradie to go handyman, hire a hubby, that kind of thing. Get them in to do anything that you can't do or don't want to do. Make sure with electricity and with anything to do with gas and probably plumbing, I like to do, but leave plumbing to somebody else as well, then get a licensed tradesperson in. Now, I'm just talking cosmetic at this stage. If there's anything to do with structurally changing things around, well, hey, you've got to get builders in and get quotes and all that kind of stuff as well. So we look at the current value of the property, if we did the renovation on it, what's that going to cost, and then what the comparable sales analysis tells you as to what your place is going to be worth when it's finished. And it's pretty easy to work out. If you go and spend $70,000, what's the increase in the value of your property? And if you spend $70,000 and the value of the property only goes up by $70,000, well, hey, it's not worth doing. You know, you're better off selling it as it is if that's the decision to do that, or revalue where it is. You know, it may not be a sell, it might be just a revalue we're talking about. So a ballpark, I like to have renovations come in these kind of figures. If I'm going to spend $20,000, I want my property to increase by $40,000 or more. If I'm going to spend $50,000, I want my property to increase by $100,000 or more, just to give you some kind of ballpark. So whatever you put into it, I like to see that back plus that much again at least to make a renovation actually worthwhile. All right, so now we've got a complete picture of if we renovate. Now that might be to either revalue or sell. Put that piece of paper to the side, get a new piece of paper out. All right, now let's go through the option of relocate. If you were to sell this property as is, then how much money would you get in your hand after paying commissions and advertising and all the rest of it? And how long was that likely to take? How much would you get in your hand and what can you do with it? So if you went out and bought another property, now with a little bit more knowledge behind you, what would you actually go and do? Could you buy something that does need renovating or subdividing or both or developing or whatever? You know, what else does your money buy? This is kind of like the opportunity cost analysis process that I teach students how to do. But this gives you some kind of idea as to what that would look like and, you know, how you can start to kind of work through these figures. So what else does your money buy? Where else can you go to make that money worth more? And what can you be doing with it? So it might be putting it into a cash cow, or it might be putting it into a manufactured growth deal of some description. So that's the relocation kind of decision-making process. And again, go out to the market, have a look what's around, you know. Could you buy a property that you're able to make more income on, where you can rent out part of it as well as live there, if it's your PPR, or if it's a property that's a straight out income property, you know, what else can you get? What higher yield can you get on that property somewhere else? So that gives you the relocation feel of what it might look like if you actually did relocate, as in sell that property and put that money into another property. And then the next thing is push that sheet of paper aside, and now we're talking development, which is detonate. So if we were to knock that that property down, and we're working through the third option now, then, you know, what's it going to be? What kind of cost is it going to be to knock that place down, clear the site? And don't underestimate that, I can tell you, because that actually does cost quite a bit of money. So what's the clearing of the site going to be? Is the house worth anything? Is it worthwhile you buying another block of land somewhere else and putting it? Is it worthwhile ringing up one of the old house graveyard people and say, come and take this wreck away? Or is it just a bulldozer, take it to the dump, pay the fees, and we've got a clear site? Then you need to go around and have a look at other new properties in your area as to what they look like. You know, what's desirable? Is it a two-bedroom, a three-bedroom, a four-bedroom? Could you put a duplex on there? Can you put a block of flats on there? What's the maximum capacity of the site? And this is where you need to be talking to town planners and to builders and to, you know, even building inspectors are going to give you some degree of an idea as to what the capacity of the site actually is. So you go around and you look at all of those sort of things, and you decide on what the what the capacity of the site is, and start to get some idea of plans. Now, there's no point reinventing the wheel. What you need to be doing is to going around and having a look at similar sized blocks and have a look at what fits on those blocks and what other people have done. Try and get some precedence in your area as to what has been done in the past. There's no point going out there and being a trailblazer. You know, get out there and copy somebody else. And the great thing to do here is actually to do what I call a reverse feasibility. So if you see a nice little triplex or a block of four or a duplex or a nice house even, and you go, you know what, that has real value, and it'll maximise my site, and you know, it's called for having a single family home or a multi-family home or whatever it is on my particular site. Find one that's similar. Do a search on it and go through and find out on that search who built it. Who was the builder? Who was the consultant? Who was the town planner? Go through all of the varying trades that will all be listed with the council in some description. A lot of that stuff can be found out simply by Googling, and find out, you know, all about that particular property, and go, you know what, I'll just ring them up. I'll ring up that town planner, and I'll ring up that surveyor, and I'll ring up that builder, and ask him, you know, what the cost was, and if you were to do a similar construction on your site, what those rough costs are going to be. Now, without actual plans and things like that, it's very hard to get a detailed cost, but at least you'll get a ballpark. And then you can start to work up out some parameters, you know, what's the council applications going to be and those sort of things. And your builder and your town planner are going to be very, very helpful with that, those types of questions. And then go and have a look and say, okay, well, what's it going to cost me to convert? What's it going to cost me to pull the thing down that's sitting on it now? What's it going to cost me to build whatever it is I'm going to go and build? And then what is it going to be valued at when I'm finished? And if there's enough profit margin in it, well, hey, you know, that may be the right option. And then you unemotionally put the three options out there and go, okay, which one makes me the most money? You know, how long is each option going to take? How does that fit in my time frame? And make a decision from there. Because that's what has to be happen. It's not just about an emotional decision. But unfortunately, most people try and make financial decisions on emotions, and it doesn't work. Numbers don't lie. So you've got to be looking at those numbers. You've got to be working out which one makes you more money within the shortest space of time. And that's the one you choose. Lay it out, get out there, and make it happen. Now, there's never going to be an exact answer one way or another because there's too many variables. It's going to depend on your current situation, where your future peg in the sand is, and your particular deal that you have. But the answer is definitely in the numbers, and it's a matter of logically, logistically working through each individual option that you've got available to you, working the numbers right through to the end, and then deciding which one is going to make you the most amount of money within the shortest space of time. Let me tell you a quick story. Sometimes more money over a longer period of time is not always the answer. It reminds me of a story of a student of mine that bought a big old house on a double block. And they had a number of options. They could, for instance, renovate the old property and sell it off. They could move the old house onto one of the blocks, renovate it, and either sell the other block of land or build on it and then sell it. They could knock down the old house, build two new houses, or knock down the old house and sell two vacant blocks of land. And, you know, they've got all of these choices available to them, and it's a case of, okay, well, which one should I do? Don't ask me which one you should do until you've done the numbers. Do the feasibility on each individual option and then work out which one suits you best. Now, in this particular case, they made the most money by knocking down the old house and building two new houses. They weren't multiple income stream properties, so blocks of land. So you could only build single houses, but that's actually where they would make the most money. And they were going to make around $300,000 to $400,000 doing that. But what they actually chose to do was to knock down the old house and sell two vacant blocks of land. Why? Because it was quick. In less than 12 weeks, they made over $100,000. Bing, bang, thank you very much, out onto the next deal. Whereas if they'd taken the construction option, they would have been there for probably a year, maybe a little longer. And yeah, they would have made more money, but they wouldn't have been able to do anything else in the meantime. So this gave them quick money to move on and go and do the next thing. And it was, for them, in their particular situation, it was the better option. In their case, quick money was good money, and it was easier for them to do that. So that's what they chose to do. So it's, as you can see, it's going to be a little bit of a different story in everybody's scenario, but I can tell you now, the numbers don't lie. So work the numbers through right out to the nth degree and work out which one makes you the most money in the time frame that suits you. Now, just to add a little bit more to that, one thing I do want you to consider when you're looking at these properties, particularly if you're looking at relocating or if you're looking at construction and then selling, what I'd like you to really consider here is that real wealth comes from accumulation, not trading. Now, that is my motto. Does it mean that I won't sell a property? Absolutely not. Of course, I'll sell a property if it's the wrong property to be keeping for what I actually want. But I will always try and keep properties if I can. Now, when you start to look at when you can keep a property and what kind of property you should be keeping, obviously it comes down to yield, because if you're buying negative cash flow properties or keeping negative cash flow properties, there's a limit as to how many you can keep, because, you know, each one you've got to be able to service. You've got to find that money somewhere else to be able to hold on to that property. Whereas when you've got positive cash flow properties, or at least properties that look after themselves, which are called neutral cash flow properties, then you don't have to sell. And if the property is not stopping you from being able to continue to invest because, you know, it's tied up all of your equity, or because it chews up all of your serviceability from a lending perspective, then, you should keep it. Because over the longer term, it will grow in value, rents will go up, and you're going to be in a much better, more wealthy situation down the track if you are able to keep it. It reminds me of a student of mine called Fred, who came to me with a bundle of photographs one day, and they were all photographs of pictures of properties, and they were all properties that he had owned over the years. Now, Fred started investing back in 1970, and back in 1970, he bought properties in Sydney in a suburb called Glebe. Now, Glebe obviously is an inner city suburb these days, but when he was buying these properties in Glebe in 1970, he paid for a very nice little terrace house on average between $11,000 and $12,000. Get that. 11 grand for a little terrace house in Glebe that today, and I tracked these properties, I tracked what they were worth, I tracked the values of these properties right through since 1970 when, you know, when Fred owned the properties, because he gave me the addresses of the properties. And today, those properties that he bought back in 1970 are worth over $1 million. Now imagine, because Fred obviously sold these properties, but imagine if Fred had been able to keep those properties. Imagine if he was able to get enough rent from those properties to be able to cover all of their costs. That's all, just cover all of their costs. That would mean that those properties from a serviceability perspective were not holding him back. They were not stopping him from being able to continue to invest. So what that would mean is that he could afford to hold those properties. Imagine today if he had all of those properties, all worth over $1 million, and even if he didn't pay off any of the mortgage, imagine if he just paid interest only on that mortgage. He'd have an $11,000 mortgage on a $1 million property. Now, isn't that silly? Yet we get so caught up in properties and all the rest of it. We sell them off prematurely. And we don't think about how we can keep those properties, which is why when you start to look at renovation and those sort of things, or even construction, you need to be very, very mindful about positive gearing and trying to keep the yield on those properties as high as you possibly can. So that's a talk for another day about how we can maximize the yield on our existing properties, but it's certainly something you need to be thinking about, and if at all possible, try and hold. I mean, I'm not saying hold if it's negative and, you know, your money's will work harder for you elsewhere doing something else, then by all means, sell, you know, relocate. But just keep in mind that over the long term, you will be a wealthier person if you hold. Remember my motto, real wealth comes from accumulation, not trading. So try not to trade, because you pay tax when you trade, and that money's then gone. And then next year, you've got to go and earn that money again. Whereas when you accumulate with positive cash flow, that positive cash flow comes in regardless of whatever else you're going to be doing next year. And, you know, then if you go and work again and you earn some more positive cash flow, well, now you've got the original one from the first year plus what you made in the second year. It accumulates like compound interest working in your favor, except now we're talking about compound passive income, which is even more valuable. So guys, bear that in mind. Real wealth comes from accumulation, not trading. So there you go, guys. Whether you should renovate, relocate, or detonate comes down to the numbers. So learn to do those numbers. I'm going to do a bit of a talk for you on the numbers one day, but not today. That's it for me. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back again to talk to you again very, very soon on another topic. Bye for now, and happy investing.